Station number 14129, Sydney East.
3-5. Where did you fly into Normandy from on the evening of the 6th of June?
Kievel. We had moved down to Kievel from Sleip some 3 months, 2 or 3 months beforehand. So we moved. We did the evening trip from Kievel. That day, we actually, very few of our squadron flew on that trip, only about half the squadron, because they weren't required. The operations had gone so well, as far as the airborne side of it had gone, that the number of lifts and equipment required had been more or less reduced. So therefore, half the squadron was still there waiting to go, and they weren't needed.
Where
Although
did
everybody
you
was prepared for it, they weren't needed.
land in Normandy?
Oh, about a mile and a half north of the, what's the river? Also, I
The River
forgot.
Orne?
On. About half a mile and a half from the bridge on the south side, as it was southeast side. Southwest side, I mean, southwest side. And we were told that there was nothing, no, there would be no problems. The only thing that there had been, which were poles that were put up, they would have all been removed by then and everything would be fine for us. But when we got over the site, there was a bit of flak around, not too bad. We realized that the poles were still there. And furthermore, as we approached the poles from about 50 feet, we could see they had huge strips of cable across them, which meant it was going to be rather dicey, that landing. So I did a rather steep turn round and waited to see somebody else go in first, being so brave. What's the bloke going in front of me? He made a lovely channel for me between the poles. His glider finished up with no wings, but on the deck, and I watched them get out. Could see them getting out as I was approaching. I thought, well, I'll follow him. And I went straight down his path and stopped before I got to him. So to me, it was a perfectly normal landing. I was an old soldier at that time, you see. I'd learnt, well, if there's going to be any trouble, let the bloke in front face it first. Not really, it's just as it happened, I think.
Can you repeat what you had on board?
A jeep and a trail of ammunition. Two troops.
So that got down safely.
Oh, perfectly, yeah. We had to knock the back off. You blow the back off and they run down the channels with the, put channel arms and run the jeep down. That was no problem at all. And in fact, Pat's glider in front of me, the one that had smashed all up, he was perfectly all right. Perfectly fine. I mean, he judged it well. It whipped the under. He broke the cable with the undercart, got below the next cable, because the undercart he dropped down below, and he just whipped the wings off. And of course, it kept going on the forward motion on skids, which slowed it right up. So he was perfectly all right. And it whipped the tail bit off, but that didn't matter. They were going to take the tail off anyway. He was lucky. Most of them were, in fact.
So once you landed, lots of troops came to unload you.
No, we had to unload it ourselves. Oh, well. And then we had to go to the edge of the field. I think we had about, I think, no, it was only about four casualties in our lot. Went to the end of the field where the RV was, and we were told to dig in for the night. And there was a bit of noise around. There was a lot of noise, in fact, thinking about it. There usually is in when you've got mortars and shells and machine guns. There's usually a lot of noise. But we didn't have any, nobody was injured that way. The only injuries were in the landings.
How did you get back?
Ah, well, at first light, well, actually, before first light, what the hell, I've forgotten the name of our bloke, came around and said, okay, lads, let's move. We're going back. So we got out of these half-dug slip trenches just before first light was, and we started going back towards what is now called Horsa Bridge. It was only, what, 20 minutes walk down the road, I suppose.
Towards Pegasus Bridge.
No, first of all, Horsa Bridge, then Pegasus Bridge afterwards. And all the troops were coming this way. We were going the other way. And there was no firing. Well, it was reasonably quiet. And by the time first light came, we were halfway to Pegasus Bridge to go back home onto Sword Beach. And about Oh, 5 o'clock in the afternoon? No. 12 o'clock. I think it was, I can't remember the time. Because we kept stopping, of course, a lot. It took us a long time to get there. Maybe 2 or 3 hours to get to the beach. When we got to the beach, we had to wait there for a couple of hours to get a landing barge to take us back. And that was it.
So no problems getting there?
None at all.
Did you cross to Normandy again?
No. No, we came back home and went on leave, as usual.
Was that your last operation in the war?
No. Then we were briefed for the Falaise Gap, the closing of the Falaise Gap. Thank God that never happened, because we'd have been blown to pieces. We had nothing to stop heavy armour. Then we were briefed for Paris. We were going to take Paris. Going to land at... Where were we going to land at? Orly, was it? Or Le Bourget somewhere? Orly. That was stopped because they were going to let the Free French do it. We were all looking forward to that one. That would have been most enjoyable, going into Paris. Then the next one was... Peenemunde. When they started the rockets, that was just after the atom bomb, the doodlebugs. We were all called, I can see it now, we were all called into the briefing room by George. It would be our lot, of course, the first lot. And the reason why we got all the time is because we were the most experienced, you see. And that's always what happens in war. The people that do it first always get pushed first. Or you could train the others. That's the idea. Anyhow, he called us in and said, well, I've volunteered for you chaps. We thought, well, that's very kind of you. We haven't volunteered. You've heard about these rockets, the V1. Yes, we'd heard about it. And then he had an RAF chap with him as well. We always had the RAF anyway. And they had a map up of where it was at Peenemunde. He said, tonight there's a 300 bomber raid going over. Now, if the raid is not successful, I volunteered that... What did he say? I can't remember how many. A squadron of gliders, anyway, would go over, land round the site and destroy it. We thought, what? And how do we get back, sir? Ah, that's the problem. That's absolutely... I can remember that. We went back to the billet. Went back to the mess, sorry. We got a few jars down us. And we said, well, I hope the RAF is successful tonight. We don't want that little lot. There was no getting back from that. Fortunately, they were, obviously. Because he called us to the brief room. The next night we thought, oh, Christ, it can't be. He said, you can relax. They've done the job. I don't know whether they had or not, but anyway, we were called off. Because that was going to be the first job the gliders ever did, which I haven't mentioned. And that was in 1942. There were two gliders who went to Norway, Strathdee and Doig, who I knew personally, and they were taking sappers to destroy the so-called heavy water plant at Vermok in November 1942. That was a really desperate mission. And they went in snowstorms, awful, and they crashed. Those that weren't killed on the crash, some were badly wounded, some weren't too bad. The badly wounded were taken to hospital, and the others were taken prisoners. A month later, under Hitler's specific orders, again, this is true, it's in history, the hospital, those in the hospitals were strangled, and the others were taken out and shot. And there is a little monument to them in Norway. So nobody was returned. After the war, fortunately, the Norwegians did keep a record, and the colonels in charge were duly hanged.
So, coming back to your own story, yeah. You were briefed for 3 abortive operations.
That's right.
Falaise Gap, capture of Paris, and the attack on Peenemunde.
That's right. There was another one which I cannot remember. There was another one, but it wasn't as bad as that Peenemunde one, I can tell you. Then we were briefed for Arnhem. That was the next one. Market Garden. Now, we were briefed a fortnight before That would be beginning of September.
This is still D Squadron, is it?
Oh, yes, yes. And it was cancelled. Because when you're briefed, you see, you're confined to camp. But it was cancelled. So we were out of camp again.
Did you know the reason?
No. Nobody told us. And then, a fortnight afterwards, briefing room again. Confined to camp. It's on. What's on? Arnhem. Oh, I thought it was cancelled. Everybody did, you see. And then they had... we had the briefing of that. How we were going to take the bridge. Where we were going to land, etc., etc. Well, the briefing was quite good. But it didn't tell us the true story, because I don't think they knew it. And the Sunday the 17th came. I had Charlie, my second pilot, who died a few years ago. We took in... We were taking some of the reconnaissance squadron. I think we had a jeep, a couple of motorbikes, that's right, and about six blokes. On the Sunday morning, it was a beautiful day, lovely Sunday, 17th, we took off. We were told there would be a cover of typhoons, and there was. We had a wonderful air cover. And we, over the wash, it was a lovely sight, all forming together over the wash. And we saw these typhoons, where there was flak barges they had, would drop down and fire a few rockets, and we could see the flak barges go up in smoke. The flight continued on. Wonderful sight, all these gliders and this huge trail across the sky on a Sunday morning. And then we came to, along the river, to Arnhem, or at least just outside Arnhem. We could see the bridge in the distance, and there was one lone AK-AK gun firing, 88 millimetre. That's all, not too bad. And we released and had a wonderful landing, could pick my spot, no problems at all. As we were the first landings, it was quite easy. You didn't have anybody to worry about in front of you, so we landed perfectly. Got all my gear out, the jeep and the motorbikes. And when I was getting out myself, I dropped my flask of hot coffee, which annoyed me. I broke it. However, I thought, that's a bad sign. I've lost my coffee. Charlie was with me. We got a lift in the jeep down to our RV, which was at the corner of LZ. Oh, I've forgotten the letter of it now. It was a corner of our LZ, anyway. And we were all together there. No, nobody was injured. Fine. We all got there. No problem. We were told then to dig in for the night, because our job would then be to guard the landing zone. And as the operation was only supposed to be 48 hours before the Second Army would come through, we had no problems. At least we didn't think we had any. And later on in the afternoon, I went on a reconnaissance with Captain Cairns, Bonehead Cairns, as he was called. And... quite uneventful, except we went to one farmhouse, which had a wall in front of it, and he sort of walked up to the door. We all got behind the wall quickly, knocked on the door, and it was opened by a Dutch lady, and he said in a loud voice, "Are there any Germans here?" We all ducked under the wall, you know, expecting all hell to be let loose. Fortunately, there weren't. And when we got back, I said to Jack, George, who was with me, I said, "That's the last time we're going to go on a recce with that idiot." However, these things do happen in wartime. It was quite an uneventful night. There was just this, an 88 which kept firing, and a mortar. Germans got some mortars going, which were a bit naughty. They're very good with their mortars. Anyhow, we survived the night, and the next morning we said, "Right, we've got to move down towards the bridge." Now, that was 7 miles away, which has got everything to do with the operation, I think. We moved down the road. We came to a crossroads where there was this German staff car with a general had been shot, and there were all the bodies round it. And I went up to loot up some buttons, but somebody had been there before me, so there weren't any buttons. I thought I'd have a button to bring back. Then we moved down towards this place called Oosterbeek. Now, the parrot, who'd gone ahead of us a couple of miles, had obviously got to the bridge. And when we got to as far as Oosterbeek, or just this side of Oosterbeek, things started to get a little bit warm. There was a lot of firing going on, and a lot of shouting and machine gunning and what have you. Our officers didn't seem to know exactly what the hell to do. So we kept on going down till we got into Oosterbeek. And then he came over and said, that's going to be the regimental headquarters, operational headquarters. Right, that was the Hartenstein Hotel. there was a bit of shooting going on by snipers and so on. But nobody had been hit yet, fortunately. And they said, well, now we want you to spread out in this wood, which was the other side of the Hartenstein, and dig in. We've got to protect the headquarters, you see, so we started to dig in our slit trenches. Then the other squadron take over those houses over there. And the Dutch were still there at that time, you see. So put a slit trench in the gardens. The Dutch people, by then, were getting a little nervous, which I'm not surprised. And the part where I was at the edge of it, there was a house. And we started to go in the garden. This woman came out and said, what you do, you see, we said, we're slit trench. Oh, you think I better go? I have old lady here. So I went in and had a look. She got a very, very old lady in there. And she was a woman, I don't know, I suppose about 45, 50. This was the daughter, I presume. And I said, well, you better, you know, have you got a cart? And they got a hand cart. Put her on that and take her out, where it's safe, away from the area. Which they did. It was very sad that you had to do that sort of thing, but what else could you do? Because by then, the road, this was at the bottom of the road, which goes down to the bridge, and this was the afternoon of the 18th. There was quite a bit of firing coming up this road, and we'd put a six-pounder gun on the corner. We could all fire that because we'd been on courses of it. And that's an anti-tank gun. And they moved away, so then we moved into the house. But we can protect this until, you know, if anything happens. Incidentally, it's gone now, and it was back the first year, but now it's gone. In the late afternoon, it really started to hot up, and there was some snipers round the roofs, and they were a bloody nuisance. And Charlie, my second pilot, who was with me, said I'd got a Sten gun, which is useless, and also a Piat. But I hadn't got the bombs for the Piat. Somebody else had got those. But this happens, you see. So, let me go back. Yes, Charlie said, I think I'll go out and do a bit of sniping. Anyway, he was a very good shot. He went down to the corner of the garden and he waited to see if somebody firing, a German firing. And then he let him have it. And he got a wonderful shot because he could hear the scream. He'd obviously hit him. So he put a notch on his rifle. And by the time we'd finished, he got quite a lot of notches on his rifle. He was very good. A very good shot, Charlie. That was it wasn't too bad the second day. We were expecting the second lift. It was all supposed to be done in three lifts. And we come down from the airfield, the landing strips, and the landing strips were supposed to have been held by the second lift. By that time, the Germans had got strength up and had moved basically onto the landing strip. So the second lift had a bit of bother getting off it. They had to fight their way off it. They had a few casualties. And the third lift had a lot of casualties, because the Germans had taken the landing strips then. Which meant that they were that side of us, and the bridge was that side of us. So that meant there were Germans on both sides, as far as we were concerned. Although our lift was supposed to be coming from this, the left-hand side, there were still a lot of Germans there amongst them. And the right-hand side, of course, was the bridge, which was friendly at the moment, but somebody came back from down there and had been watching, said there's a hell of a battle going on down there. This was at the bridge. And then some of the bigger gliders have brought some, what the hell do we call them? Bren carriers. And one of our chaps was in these, and he said, I'm going down at the bridge. I believe they're short of ammunition. And somebody else came back and said, well, you can't get down to the bridge. There was no sort of set battle because at the early days there was no communication. So it was all sort of what you could see, basically. As we didn't know exactly what was going on, it was all very difficult to read the battle. Anyway, this chap went down. He said, well, I'm going. We said, well, all right, well, I'm certainly not going with you because I don't know what's going on down there. He went down there and he was blown to bits, you know, by a tiger tank, which was coming up the other way. I had a feeling. It was the battle. Now, that night, the third lift was going to come. Those that were saved from the second lift had joined us. And we were basically in the woods and the bungalows all around the perimeter. And the bridge was about a mile and a half down the road, 2 miles down the road. And it was quite quiet at night. That second night was reasonably quiet. But at 5 o'clock in the morning, the Germans put a stunk on us of mortars. They got a hell of a lot of mortars from somewhere. And then we realised there were a hell of a lot of Germans around, which nobody told. They said, all you're going to meet, all the opposition is the Volkssturm and a few Hitler Younger. In fact, there were two SS battalions. Never mind. Regiments, sorry, being refitted. Waffen-SS, rather than SS. Waffen-FS is the very good German soldier. And we really had to put our heads down, and it made a mess everywhere. Quite a lot of blokes were killed. And then they had a habit of doing it. They'd put it on early morning, then they'd stop. And you could go around and pick up your dead. And then they had a long tom gun which was firing from somewhere. We could hear that coming over. The third day was the third lift. We were, first of all, in the morning, we thought it was the third lift, and in fact, it was a squadron of German fighters coming in. They stonked us, but fortunately, didn't do any damage. They could have done, because we were all leaping about thinking they were our aircraft, and they weren't. But they didn't hit anybody, fortunately. They were machine gunning. That's Jack came down that afternoon on that third lift. He joined me in our slit trench in the front of this house. We'd moved out to that then because the house was getting a few shells in it. You see, the house is an obvious target. And the padre came round, I think, that day. We'd still got food at the moment and ammunition. Nothing, apart from that tank coming up the road, which frightened us all to death, nothing had happened. Now, that tank was knocked out by Mike Dauncey on the third day. He borrowed my Piat. He'd found some bombs. I had a Piat and no bombs. He had the bombs and no Piat. So he said, I'm going to take this. And he went down the road and he knocked the tank out. Very, very good. He was a good lad. He was badly wounded down at the chest later on.